is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker once again, one and all, welcome to the one and only Grillion Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South. Joining me in studio, the boys in the bunker, Caleb Hanks, our producer and engineer. Good evening, Caleb, and how are you?
I'm good, Micah. How you doing?
I'm marvelous, as always. And then holding up the very fashionable end of the darkest corner of the World Wide Web we call the Grillion Report, associate producer Mr. Jeremy London, who I actually prefer to call kind of like the Grillion manager guy. So glad you're in here keeping me on task. I really need it. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing good.
Great.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you in here. Joining us later in the program, none other than B. Timothy Pennington, Ph.D. He's the author of a brand new book I have here in my algae-stained paws. It's called Science, Skeptics, and UFOs. A Reluctant Scientist Explores the World of UFOs. I've really enjoyed reading this book, and just wait until you hear what he has to say about UFOs in Hour 2. It's going to be hard to follow a show like last week where we had Richard Dolan join us here talking about UFOs, but you've heard what a historian has to say about the subject. Now I want you to hear what a scientist, a member of the American Chemist Society, and also a lifelong experiencer. He's not an abductee, but he has had a number of incredible encounters throughout his life with unidentified flying objects. He'll be talking about that with us during Hour 2. But here's what's going on in the world at large right now. You know, here in the bunker, the guys and I have been looking at what's been happening. And you get a good workout when you're trying to follow the world of the weird news, as we do every day here at the Grillion Report. As a matter of fact, I would hazard to guess that we get an awful lot of exercise. But you got to be careful, because scientists are now warning that too much exercise could actually kill you. In fact, it may not always be good for your health. According to new research, which found that 1 in 20 people may be overexerting themselves. Which one of you guys, before we went to air, mentioned Bruce Lee?
It was Caleb.
Not me. I didn't do it, Micah.
It was Caleb.
It was him.
No.
It was.
Oh, man. Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee, you know, he may be a famous case of someone who really, I mean, he had almost zero body fat, and it's to the point where it was literally unhealthy, maybe. Although many also said that he had one of the finest physiques in the world. Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course, had even said that. Well, researchers studied the relationship between exercise and cardiovascular disease-related deaths in about 2,400 physically active heart attack survivors recently. Their study confirmed that previous reports indicating that cardiovascular benefits for walking and running were equivalent as long as the energy expenditures were the same. Reductions in deaths from cardiovascular events of up to 65% were seen among patients who were running fewer than 30 miles or walking fewer than 46 miles per week. You know, recently while visiting the Chimney Rock State Park here in North Carolina, my dear friend Laura Gardner had told me she had a friend who did the 30 miles, the 30 by 30 challenge, I think is what they call it. But when she turned 30, she ran 30 miles. And I said, well, what are you going to do when you turn 40, right? I doubt you're going to run 40 miles. This study seems to suggest that patients who are running fewer than 30 miles or walking fewer than 46 miles per week actually had reductions in deaths from cardiovascular events. Now, beyond that point, much of the benefit of exercise was lost. According to study co-author Dr. Paul Williams of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, he said these analyses provide what is, to our knowledge, the first data in humans demonstrating a statistically significant increase in cardiovascular risk with the highest levels of exercise. So I think that, you know, when we look at the idea of excess is best, obviously, it's not. And we know that, you know, there are certain foods you shouldn't eat too much of. You want to cut back on, you know, your alcohol intake beyond a point. Although some studies suggest that if you are a teetotaler, you're actually at as much risk as a person who drinks too much. And just the same, I think when we see with exercise, you don't do any of it well, you're going to live a sedentary lifestyle and you're going to be more prone to health risks. You exercise too much and you very well may be in the same situation. So really, I think it's all about with the subtleties and maybe even the frailties of the human body at times, it's all about finding balance. Too little or too much of anything can be, well, too bad.
Do you think the Proclaimers are still alive after walking 500 miles and then walking 500 more?
Well, just
I think they walked 1,000 miles.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think that adds up.
If they did it in one day, they wouldn't be much better for it. You know, I'll tell you something else that we were all a little better for, the funny man, who Caleb and I just learned about immediately prior to going on air last night. But our Graylian listeners who may not have caught the last night's Michael Hanks radio program on the KGRA radio network, you haven't heard what we've had to say. Robin Williams, of course, brilliant actor and comedian. He's been reported as, again, being someone who had recently attended rehab. He had been suffering from depression, and now, of course, it has been reported that we've lost the brilliant actor. He was 63 years old. Now, he went on to become the alien Mork from Ork in his breakout hit 70s sitcom Mork and Mindy. He also very famously portrayed the voice of the genie in Aladdin. He was a hyperdisc jockey, probably one of my very favorite roles that he ever played. Of course, you know, being a radio guy. That was the film Good Morning Vietnam. Of course, maybe his most beloved performance, Mrs. Doubtfire. He was set to actually do an encore performance of Mrs. Doubtfire, to reprise the role, as it were, in a sequel that was coming up shortly. But unfortunately, that, of course, will not happen now. Apparently, he had hung himself, had been severely depressed, and the family is, of course, you know, wishing for privacy and prayers also as they're coping with this tragedy. Jeremy, before we went to air, you know, you and I were talking about this a little bit. This death struck me harder, I think, than a lot of celebrity deaths, and I just have to be completely honest to people. I'm not weighing, you know, individuals with the merit of their work, but, you know, it was tough for a lot of us when we heard about Philip Seymour Hoffman earlier this year. Something about Robin Williams strikes you to your core. I don't know what exactly it is.
It's like losing a member of your family. I mean, you grew up with him. I grew up with him.
Yeah, you know, and I think as you'd pointed out, you know, that there's... Are they drilling again down here?
The Hadles are trying to break into some new oil refineries.
Yeah, absolutely. Those crystalline boreholes that they're working on, I always worry about that. But anyway, with Robin Williams, something you pointed out, Jeremy, is that, you know, he really, truly did have a cross-generational appeal, whether it was the 1970s with Mork and Mindy. You know, there have been actors who have kind of, you know, come and gone, or they've made comebacks. You know, famously, I think we think of John Travolta. But when it comes to people who have really just gone up and up and up and who have maintained appeal, you know, Robin Williams was one of those people who maintained a lot of appeal over many generations, over a large demographic. I mean, it wasn't just comedy. You know, he played serious roles just as well. I was trying to remember the name of the film. Do you remember the one I was talking about, where he was the photo lab guy and
1 hour photo?
One, yeah. Very disturbing film. You're right. Yeah.
Thank you, Caleb.
But you remember the one I'm talking about,
yeah.
Right? You know, just it's truly disturbing and it's so sad. And my dear Aunt Purple on Facebook posted just yesterday, why is it that the people that make us laugh in life the most are the ones who are always crying on the inside? Well, you know, I like to remember the man and the merit of his work for the brighter times. And here, Jeremy had suggested that we wanted to try and find the perfect audio clip to feature tonight. This is actually from the film The Dead Poets Society, known otherwise as the Seize the Day clip. I think it's very fitting in remembering the late Robin Williams.
A lot of you look forward to this about as much as you look forward to root canal work. We're going to talk about Shakespeare as someone who writes something very interesting. Now, many of you have seen Shakespeare done very much like this. O Titus, bring your friend hither. But if any of you have seen Mr. Marlon Brando...
No, but Shakespeare can be different. France, Romans, countrymen, Lamiris.
You can also imagine maybe John Wayne is Macbeth going, well, is this a dagger I see before me? Why do I stand up here? Anybody?
To feel taller.
No. Thank you for playing, Mr. Dalton. I stand upon my desk to remind myself that we must constantly look at things in a different way. See, the world looks very different from up here. You don't believe me? Come see for yourselves. Come on. Come on. Just when you think you know something, you have to look at it in another way. Even though it may seem silly or wrong, you must try. Now, when you read, don't just consider what the author thinks. Consider what you think. Boys, you must strive to find your own voice. But the longer you wait to begin, the less likely you are to find it at all. Thoreau said most men lead lives of quiet desperation. Don't be resigned to that. Break out. Now, don't just walk off the edge like lemmings. Look around you. There you go, Mr. Christie. Thank you. Yes.
dare to strike out and find new ground.
We do have to, in life, walk out. We have to find new ground, and we can't live in quiet desperation. You know, maybe at the end of his life, for all we know, Robin Williams was living in quiet desperation, but I hope he knows wherever he is right now, how many lives he touched. I hope he remembers the love that has been sent his way and the appreciation that we have for his influence on us. Let us not move forward in quiet desperation. Let us move forward together in laughter, in humor, but also in humility and in happiness, celebrating the life of Robin Williams. We're going to take you back in time when we come back 70-some thousand years here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us. To fringe theorists and Fortians around the globe, I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. Glad to be spending our time with you on Tuesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. East Coast time or worldwide around the globe, anywhere on the internet, anytime. If you'd like to take us with you, we're available on iTunes. And of course, you know what we ask you to do is to tell your friends if you enjoy what you hear on the Graylian Report. It's the home, we like to think, of rationale and reason. You know, in the next hour, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking with B. Timothy Pennington. He's a PhD chemist who held his silence about his family's UFO experiences for decades and finally couldn't do it any longer. And he made that leap into the realm of, well, the fringe, like many of us have, from a science background, because he really truly wants to accept and also help other people accept and understand what he believes is truly anomalous phenomenon going on around us in the world. And speaking of anomalous phenomenon going on around us in the world, I want to recommend something to you. If you aren't already a subscriber to Graylian X, you can get additional editions of the Graylian Report, our Graylian X podcast, as well as the monthly Enigmas. This month is going to be a truly unsettling case. With Enigmas, you know, we take a slightly more theatrical approach. There's definitely a kind of an aura of mystique and the eerie with the program. Kind of hails back to old programs that I grew up watching. I loved Unsolved Mysteries, but especially In Search Of. Well, we try to get a little bit of that feel in this program. But all I'm going to tell you about this month's Enigmas, which we hope to have out by the end of this week, it has to do with a missing person case. And I'll tell you, it's one for the books, but not just a missing person case. Also, a serial killer who was never apprehended, and a vampire. I hope that piques your interest a bit. In past editions of the program, we featured the Dyatlov Pass incident, the true story of what may be sea serpents out there in our waterways around the world. We've looked at the William Rowe Bigfoot encounter, the Pascagoula abduction of 1973 involving Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker. We look at some of the most intriguing and compelling cases anywhere in the world, the twilight realm known as Fortiana, and we bring those to you once a month on Enigmas, along with other content, and a weekly additional podcast known as the Graylian X podcast. So there's a lot for you there. All you got to do to find that is just visit graylianreport.com, and you'll see the little link up there near the top of the page. Subscribe to Graylian X. It's simple. It's only $7 a month, and if you sign up for a year at a time, you get the first month free. You actually get a free month with your subscription at $77 annually. It's not bad. And speaking of that lucky number seven, let's go back in time, 70,000 years or so, to where a new archaeological discovery in Botswana seems to show that our ancestors in Africa engaged in ritual practices, 70,000 years ago, 30,000 years earlier than the oldest finds as yet known in Europe. Now, this sensational discovery, which was actually sent along to me by a dear friend of the program, Dr. Maxim Kammerer, this actually strengthens Africa's position as the cradle of modern man. Associate Professor Sheila Colson from the University of Oslo in Norway can now show that modern humans, Homo sapiens, have performed advanced rituals in Africa for what is believed to be 70,000 years. And she has, in other words, discovered mankind's oldest known ritual. But get this, the world's oldest ritual ceremony, as it is being recognized here, twice as old as previously thought, deals with, well, humans sacrificed with spearheads to pythons. That's right, humans sacrificed to pythons. Think how many cultures around the world have worshipped reptilians and snakes. It's almost eerie. And I just have to quote Indiana Jones before anybody else can do it. Snakes, man. Why does it always have to be snakes?
Jones. Jones. It's Mr. Jones to you, lady.
I'd take Mr. Jones any day over snakes.
I think I'd rather be decapitated than eaten by a python while still alive.
It's always the snakes. That's just so strange to me. So, well, anyway, make of it what you will. But we're talking about a 70,000-year-old ritual that seems to point back to, well, a much older lineage. Not just a snake cult, although that seems to be sort of what this is, but a ritual that goes back twice as long into ancient human history as we thought it actually, well, that ritual practices had actually gone. Now, the archaeologists from the Department of Archaeology, Conservation, and Historical Studies made this surprising discovery while she was studying the origin of the Sands people in cooperation with the University of Tromsø and the University of Botswana. A group of the San live in the sparsely inhabited area of northwestern Botswana known as Nagniland. Try saying that three times fast. Now, Coulson made the discovery while searching for artifacts from the Middle Stone Age in the only hills present for hundreds of kilometers in any direction, a likely place where they thought maybe some people had been drawn. Of course, because of the elevated spot, you might think that, well, it wouldn't be an obvious place that people might go and make sacrifices or in other circumstances make appeals to gods. And Caleb, what kind of gods? Do you know?
The Reptilian Uprisings.
Of course, it had to be snakes, didn't it? The python is one of the San's most important animals. According to their creation myth, mankind descended from the python, and the ancient and stream beds, or the arid stream beds around the hills in the area where these ritual sites were found are said to have been created by the python itself as it circled the hills in its ceaseless search for water. Interesting. Boy, I wish I had two sets of eyes and four sets of hands in addition to the ones that I already have, because I'd love to be able to see really what's going on in the chat room here. I can glance. I bet there's going to be some interesting conversation. And boy, are there ever a lot of people in the chat room. If you'd like to jump in there with us and you're listening to this podcast after the fact, just know that between 8 and 10 p.m. East Coast time, if you're listening to the Graylian Report, you can go to graylianreport.com/podcast and radio. We've got an interactive chat room there where we've got a lot of people. And I see a lot of them are tossing some interesting things out. As a matter of fact, we've got Indrid Cold of MIB fame who's saying that there's an anaconda right now loose in Jersey. Did you guys see the video of the large African lion yet?
I did not see
in California.
I did not see the big cat. Apparently a cat specialist said that he really thinks it is a lion.
It really looks like a lion. Jeremy, have you seen that yet?
Yeah, I saw it. It looks like a lion to me. And it doesn't look like
It doesn't look like a mountain lion.
Suddenly, his voice just got really sexy.
Really deep. Yeah.
You just turned into NPR, buddy.
No, we don't want that, remember? I've gotten so many people in the listening.
Today on Coffee Talk.
I actually happen to be drinking Guatemalan blend right now.
It's delicious, by the way, Micah.
Yes, Jeremy and I are both partaking in some coffee here. Yeah. Now, Richard Dolan last week on the show, that was one of the interesting things that so many people have reached out to me and mentioned, is his allegation that a person with NPR had said that they were always instructed at the NPR radio network. Oh, well, I guess, you know, National Public Radio, technically not really a network, but I don't know. And they apparently have told commentators, you don't ever talk about UFOs unless it's in a dismissive fashion. You know, that's something I want to talk with B. Timothy Pennington, Ph.D., about in the next hour, because throughout his book, not only talks about his own experiences, that's not really what the book's about. It's called Science, Skeptics, and UFOs. And sure, he was a reluctant scientist. I think a lot of scientists who try to tackle seriously the discussion of UFOs, I think that they are reluctant to come into the fray, so to speak. But, I mean, just to give you a little example of what we're going to be talking about, which kind of is a great addenda to what Richard Dolan had to say last week about the giggle factor that NPR and other, you know, organizations tend to kind of apply to the UFO subject. The description of the book reads, on a farm in central Mississippi in the 1970s, the author and his family were surprised to find themselves in the middle of a hotbed of UFO activity. Now, in 1977, the author, a scientist, turned to the book UFOs Explained by Philip J. Klass, looking for answers. But he found the explanations didn't really fit. Now, for years, he drifted in indecision, unable to fully come to grips with what he and his family had experienced. But knowing that UFOs were a taboo subject to most mainstream scientists, he was quite reluctant to come forward on the subject of UFOs during his career. Well, after his retirement, abandoning his concerns, the author takes the reader on a journey of full disclosure and discovery. And I have to say, this is coming from a member of the academic establishment. This is maybe one of the most open-minded but thorough and truly scientific explanations. Well, it's not so much an explanation. I'm sorry. It's an examination of the UFO phenomenon. I know that the good doctor has his own perspectives on things, and we'll talk with him during hour two about that. But, you know, it's important, I think, that we see scientists who are willing to say, okay, look, here's the technology, and here's the data that we have, but we don't have a complete picture, and we don't really know what this all means just yet. And another story that caught my eye this week, guys, apparently the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recently requested a figure for its annual report to show temperature trends over the last 10,000 years, and there seemed to be an evident problem. Apparently, Zhengyu Liu from the University of Wisconsin says that data from observation suggests that the Earth is cooling, while the physical data suggests the complete opposite. So we're getting a bit of a dichotomy, and thus climate scientists are a bit confused.
Yeah, it seems like the press is just making this out like global warming is just taking a hiatus. They're like, yeah. You know what, dude? I'm just going to chill for a little bit. You just go ahead and do what you want to do.
So. I'm sure you did too. As a matter of fact, I saw that headline that actually referred to it as global warming on hiatus. I think the question is really again, do we have a complete understanding of the science? Because, you know, there are people out there who would still try and say, no, don't even talk about this. Don't be a climate denier. I'm not trying to be. I'm just reading again. What the headlines actually say here, according to an intergovernmental panel on climate change, they now say that, well, basically our observation of data says that the Earth is cooling, but physical data suggests that there are indeed warming trends. So what do we make of this? It's pretty interesting. The problem, they say, has been termed the Holocene temperature conundrum. It has tremendously important implications for understanding climate change and, of course, evaluating climate models worldwide and throughout history. The authors have, however, emphasized that this does not negate the evidence of human impact on global climate beginning in the 20th century, i.e. anthropogenic global warming. The question, they say, remains nonetheless, who's right? Now, Liu, who I'd mentioned beforehand, suggests that maybe none of us are completely right. He suggests a data problem or perhaps a model problem. In other words, for example, some physical mechanisms may be missing from the model. Folks, this is a climate scientist who's suggesting maybe some physical mechanisms are missing from the model. Maybe no one is completely right. Maybe there are problems with the data. Again, I've never said on this program, I think that there's a conspiracy to try and trick people into thinking that the world is heating up when it's just the opposite. I've said, maybe while we think we have, as arrogant as humankind tends to be, a full understanding of the science before us, maybe that is in fact not the case. And maybe it is a byproduct of our limited understanding of the data before us, or perhaps even our tendency to kind of follow a certain thread in the absence of what real, true analytical science should dictate that leads us toward a preconceived notion of what we're supposed to be seeing or what we expect to see, and hence we have a bit of a confirmation bias that erupts out of it. I've always said maybe it's a problem with the way we interpret this data, and that is leading us to actually misinterpret what otherwise might be good data.
Maybe the scientists aren't running the correct algorithms.
You know, I really think you might.
The listeners at home can't see me giving the doctor evil face, but that's what's
right.
Happening.
He's even got his pinky up to the side of his face like that, so who knows? But again, you know, I think that this has always been something that I've felt was probably going on here. You know, you don't have to have a wide-reaching conspiracy, but by the same token, you'd be foolish, I think, not to see that there is a problem with what we see going on in the world, what we feel when we step outside, and, you know, what the climate scientists have been telling us. I don't think that they're trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes intentionally. Maybe a few of them are, honestly. But in truth, I think that the bigger problem, despite maybe random instances where there are some people that are so beholden to a belief system that they'll tell you anything so long as it matches the quote-unquote scientific accepted, you know, mainstream perspective, I think that really at the fundamental base of all of this is that there is an anthropomorphic issue, yeah, and it's not about humans heating up the environment so much as it is humans allowing their perception to get in the way of what science should be telling them. Again, this is something you're going to hear throughout the program tonight because this was the argument that Timothy Pennington, PhD, had with Philip Klass. He says, here Klass was looking at highly anomalous events, the likes of which, for instance, the Tehran incident of 1976 in Iran that Richard Dolan discussed with us on the program last week. Philip Klass said, well, these pilots were flying rickety old Tomcat aircraft, and they were chasing the planet Venus. And that explains an object that seemed to be moving. At one instance, the object moved so close to one of the pilots that he said, I thought that I had a missile fired at me, and I actually tried to fire a missile, okay, in response to what I thought was a object being propelled toward me, and he said, my missile systems shut down when I tried to do it. The weapon systems on his aircraft failed. And he said that he, as I think his name was Jafar, the pilot, as he tried to fly away after attempting to intercept this object, he said he was followed by one of these things. And over two consecutive nights following this, there were continual radar displays and reports from other pilots that said that they were seeing these things. And according to officials, there was an article at Forbes magazine last year that talked about this, that I think the journalist was Michael Peck that wrote it. In this article, this guy had apparently said that the Iranians at the time believed that these were CIA drones. And I've actually gotten some very intelligent commentary from the listenership. One individual who I haven't got his permission to talk about it on the air, so I won't at this time, but he was talking about how it sounded to him like a jamming event, where basically this was probably some sort of an aircraft that was utilizing a signal jammer, and that this was giving bad information about the actual speed of the aircraft and some of the things that were going on. But then again, I mean, to me, some aspects of this case certainly seem to be a little more anomalous than that. But I mean, I couldn't tell you that because I wasn't there. I wasn't one of these pilots. I didn't see what was going on. The point is there seemed to be an actual interaction with an aircraft, whatever that anomalous or unknown may have been. And I don't think that Venus hanging steadily in the sky, unmoving. You remember, Jeremy, I said, why the hell does Venus come down out of the sky and fly in circles around aircraft? It did it to Frederick Valentich.
I'm sorry, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
I know. But see, again, you know, here's a very science-minded guy, Philip Klass. And not everything that Pennington has to say in his book about Klass is bad. He actually even says that, you know, in order to be able to account for the anomalous nature of some of the early UFO cases that Klass looked into, he proposed this whole plasma theory. The reason he proposed a plasma theory is because he didn't want to have to, you know, cave to the idea of, you know, obviously something truly anomalous, i.e. extraterrestrials. But he realized that there was something that seemed to be strange enough, like independent aerial anomalies and illuminations, that he proposed a theory. Keep in mind, how scientific is this? A theory that he didn't have a whole lot of scientific justification for, or any way to prove. We still haven't proven the free-form plasma thing, the ball lightning thing. We know it exists. We know very little about it. I love it when scientists try and propose another hypothetical as an explanation for an unknown.
Right.
That's not very good science right there. That is not good science. And that's something that Klass, time and time and time again, did. Which, by the way, leads me to something else I wanted to talk about a bit. Have you guys heard that Brian Dunning of the Skeptoid podcast is going to, I think he's doing time something to the tune of 15 months?
Whatever for?
Well, you know, the Daily Grail carried this story, and I'd actually been following this myself. Red Pill Junkie, he's in the chat room right now, and of course, dear friend of the program, our official comments moderator, and much more here at Grailian Report. Red Pill had said, you know, if you really want to get a good feel for Brian Dunning and his attitudes toward things, watch him on the Joe Rogan podcast. I've talked about this in the past. In my opinion, I watched the show, and I'd never considered like Joe Rogan to be like an extremely intellectual dude. He's a funny guy. He's very smart, but he's not like, you know, an erudite scholarly type or anything. But in my humble opinion, he wiped the floor with Brian Dunning for about 3 hours on that show. I mean, I could not believe not only how well informed Rogan is, but also the way that he was able to point out what I truly think is a pathological skeptical attitude that a lot of these skeptics, in this case Brian Dunning, actually have. Well, so Dunning, you know, this guy who on the program continually takes issue with pseudoscientists that he feels profit from pseudoscience that is potentially dangerous to others. The story, apparently, that was carried at the Daily Grail, I should try and pull it up here, actually, because I'm just pulling this off the top of my head. It came to mind literally as we were just discussing this, but Greg Taylor over at the Daily Grail talked about this. I've actually got the article here. This is part of the problem here. Dunning is somebody who seems to think that it's ethical to go after other pseudoscientists for things that they say, when in fact, according to his website, he posts a message about his conviction and sentencing and saying he's going to own this. This is apparently, and Greg Taylor featured this at dailygrail.com, this is what he said the basis of this entire prison sentence was. And keep in mind, apparently he's been sentenced to 15 months in a federal prison for defrauding eBay of hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is what he said on his website. Quote, we developed, he and I believe this was, I guess his business partner, thought he may have actually had a relation to the individual, but so apparently this is he and his business partner, a company called Kessler's Flying Circus, or KFC. This is what he wrote about it on his website. We developed a pair of useful widgets, profile maps, that, one word, that showed a map of visitors to your MySpace page, and then Who Linked, a WordPress plugin that showed who has linked to your blog. These both included an eBay advertisement, he says. Amazingly, these both went viral, and through 2006 and 2007, our ads drove enough new customers to eBay US to earn our company about $5.3 million. Medunning says, keep in mind, that was the company's gross revenue. We had overhead and employees and costs like every other company. I was the second highest paid employee, and I did earn over $1 million personally over 2006 and 2007 before taxes. Okay. That's what Dunning says at his website. However, as Greg Taylor at Daily Grail points out, the original indictment describes the crime involving cookie stuffing in a very different way. This is what the indictment actually reads. Quote, the defendant, Dunning, provided free applications at two of his websites that users could download and use on their own websites, profilemaps.info, which showed the physical location of visitors on a MySpace profile, and wholinked.com, which showed who was linking to the user's website or blog. Okay, so far everything matches up pretty well. Any visitor to those websites could download either or both applications. Both applications included code that operated as follows. When a user visited a website that had installed the profile maps or WhoLinked applications, the code would cause the user unknowingly to receive an eBay and or CJ cookie with KFC's affiliate ID without the user having clicked on an eBay ad or link, and without the user knowing that his or her browser had been redirected to eBay and or CJ affiliate tracking servers, and without the user seeing any content of an eBay site at all. As a result, KFC, Dunning's company, would be paid if that user subsequently conducted an eBay revenue action within a certain period of time. What about that is not unethical? And boy, does he describe it differently at his website. Again, a guy who's gone on numerous podcasts, and of course his own Skeptoid podcast, and decried the way that pseudoscientists essentially defraud people of money by pandering BS. Now, what's worse? A person who gives you bad information that you can independently go out and you can research for yourself and decide whether you want to accept or not, whether it be faith healing, whether it be snake oil, I don't care. What's worse, that or a person who gives you access to an app that you didn't know was going to redirect you to a site and was going to get him a ping back and financial profit from coding that was not only misleading, but that you had no knowledge of, that he benefited from after the fact, and did so in an illegal fashion, as it turns out, which has led to his imprisonment for 15 months.
Was it in his user agreement?
good question. I'd like to know if there was a user agreement that said anything about that, because as this indictment says, it says that apparently the trackers might not even see any content on an eBay site. Now, again, let's look at what Dunning says. He says, amazingly, these both went viral, these plugins that he designed. And he says, and through 2006 and 2007, our ads drove enough new customers to eBay to earn us about $5.3 million. Huh. I don't even think you told half the story, Brian. If his wrist was in front of me, I'd smack it right now. But it sounds like he's already been more than smacked on the wrist. It's a little bit troubling, though, when we have these higher-than-mighty skeptics. And there are things that Brian Dunning has done and written that in the past that I've liked a lot. I think he's done a really good job with some things. But I love it when we see somebody who jumps up and down on this higher-than-mighty, you know, soapbox of his, talking about how unethical certain actions carried out by those in the fringe movement. I'm sure he would think that I am unethical and disingenuous, or at very least just, well, maybe an idiot, for talking about the kinds of things that we try to bring to you in a very, very rational way on this program every week. I'm sure he would probably take issue with that. I'm sorry, I don't think anybody's going to remember Brian Dunning in the future for being anything less than someone who lied to people, essentially, and profited from it. That, my friends, is unethical. So disturbing. When we come back, we'll look at a few more things in the news here in the Graylian Report, and then we'll be talking later with Timothy Pennington, PhD. Stay with us.
For you, it feels bad.
pronounced indictment.
It's because you're from the South.
Yeah, I know. There go people picking on me for my Southern
it's
accent.
It's not indictment. It's also ridiculous.
Well, I think it was a Freudian slip because we were talking about so much dickishness.
We said it twice.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I was trying to drive the point home. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. Hey, I want to point out something else. And by the way, thanks to the folks in the chat room for pointing out my Southern drawl. Done it again. You know, there are a lot of folks out there who just think it's damn sexy the way I talk. Anytime you hear me mispronunciate a word, just imagine it's Elvis saying it, and it'll all be better. The drums, you know this is Caleb, of course, singing right here, but the guy playing drums on this recording is none other than Mr. Jeremy London sitting in here in the studio with us. And I tell you, it's great to have incredibly talented musicians all around us. You know, guys, I know what we got to do. We need this seriously. We've talked about this for 100 years. We need to put together the Graylian Band and just take it on the road. Serious. Like, you know, you play drums and bass and guitar, and you know, Tyler plays bass and guitar, and I play guitar and sing, and Caleb does everything.
Yeah.
Caleb's a flautist.
Yes, I am the flautist.
Yeah. So I think it'd be fun, actually. Anyway, so, and by the way, you know, I've always believed in the old adage, you know, judge not lest ye be judged. And I'm not trying to judge Brian Dunning. I do want to be clear about that. I just think, though, that it's extremely sad when we see someone who kind of crusades against pseudoscience because of what he perceives as people being disingenuous and often trying to benefit from being disingenuous and also from pandering to paranoia, you know, to ignorance. And yet this guy is involved in, and to the tune of profiting personally with more than $1 million from basically lying to people or from being disingenuous about something that he was providing, a service he was providing. You know, that's terrible. But, I mean, I think this is the thing. Nobody's Lily White. Nobody's perfect, you know. And I know what it feels like because I've been there in the past, like all of us have been, all of us, where I feel like I've said something or done something, you know, that hurt a friend. And all we can hope to do is to move on but learn from our mistakes and to do better. And maybe Brian Dunning will learn from this. I don't think it's going to make him want to go out and read UFO books, but I hope maybe he will learn as a person. And in truth, and I don't think it's an unfair statement if I say that I think that he will have had a lesson both in humility and also hypocrisy and understanding the definition of both of those words a little better, maybe as a result of all of this. So, but I wish him the best. I wish him well. You know, and I hope that he, as an individual, I hope he grows and learns from this. That said, you know, I've been corresponding with people all week, and there've been a lot of interesting emails coming in. Something that really caught my attention, and I don't think we talked about it last week on the Graylian Report, but I think I did mention it on the Graylian X podcast, is this interesting photograph. We've got it linked on the top of the Graylian Daily News today. And the link is titled Ghosts of Salem, or is it pronounced Salam? I'm not sure.
As-salamu.
It's okay. Ghosts of Salem. This is one of the most incredible ghost photos we've ever seen. This is a photo that was sent along to Jim Harold. And if you click that link, it'll take you to Jim's website. But we featured it on the Paranormal Report this week. And by the way, if you don't know about the Paranormal Report, it's a free 30-minute or so video show that Jim and I do once a week. And we feature all the best and the latest paranormal videos, including user submissions. And so I want to reach out to you right now. Whether you're someone who just has a story you want to tell and you'd like to email me, info@graylianreport will get you directly in touch with me. But if you have a video or a photo that you would like to share for submission to the Paranormal Report, you can send that along to me just as well at info@graylianreport.com. My other email works as well, info@micahhanks.com. I'd love to hear from you if you've got something that you think is, you know, it doesn't have to prove the unexplained, but it's got to be a good video. I'll leave the interpretation up to the viewers, but if you've got something that you think is worthy and you'd like to send that along, that's how you do it. We always love to hear from folks out there who have things that they'd like to share. In terms of other headlines this week, you know, we've got a lot of good stuff over here, and the guys and I were kind of going over these before we came to air. And here's an interesting one, which I don't know if we really got time to delve into it, but the question that the headline poses is an interesting one. Rosie O'Donnell, as I understand, I guess, is going back to The View. Is that what's happening?
What?
Yeah, I know. Big news.
Really big news.
Oh, my God.
Well, But the thing is that there was an article. As a matter of fact, I'll just pull it up really quickly, because the question about Rosie is this. Is basically the fact that people like she and Jenny McCarthy are, we know that McCarthy, of course, famously has been for some time a vaccine denier. Well, Rosie O'Donnell in this Washington Post article is described as a 9/11 truther. As a matter of fact, it actually reads here. Let's see.
Speaking of vaccines, did you see that 12-year-old girl died from that HPV vaccine recently?
I did not.
Yeah, that's kind of scary. I mean, I'm sure it was some sort of allergic reaction that was specific to her, but that's still kind of unsettling.
Yeah, certainly. Well, you know, but again, you know, in relation to that, I should read this little bit about Jenny McCarthy. Okay, McCarthy's poison is myths about medicine that pose real dangers to public health. It juxtaposes that against O'Donnell, who it turns out does not believe that terrorists attacked the World Trade Center on September 11th. Now, McCarthy has become notorious for her views on vaccination and autism. There's a website called JennyMcCarthyBodyCount.com that keeps a grim tally of preventable illnesses and deaths that can be attributed to a failure to vaccinate. But O'Donnell is hardly alone in embracing September 11th-related conspiracies in the name of rationalism and scientific inquiry. Such perspectives show up with some regularity in the entertainment industry, and holding them has not exactly made their arguments or their adherents marginal figures. Now, Roberto Orci, the prolific Hollywood screen and television writer and producer, has expressed skepticism about what happened on September 11th. The actor Daniel Shunjata is a fan of the truther movie Loose Change and has appeared on conspiracy theorist Alex Jones's radio show. Jones cheerfully described Shunjata as prominent 9/11 truther and gave him credit for advocating for the inclusion of 9/11 conspiracy storylines in the show Rescue Me. Ed Asner has made a taped statement raising 9/11 truth or questions in a video address to the Federal Commission responsible for investigating the attacks, and Martin Sheen credited his son Charlie with convincing him to take questions about the official narratives and attacks more seriously. Now, in the article it reads, "It's easy to see why vaccine denialism elicits such disgust. The American public loves judging other people's parenting decisions." But skipping ahead to the 9/11 thing, the vaccine deniers and 9/11 truthers have a great deal in common, but both claim, of course, basically bad science. Vaccine deniers cite a retracted study published from the Lancet organization in 1998 that claimed to demonstrate a link between vaccination incidences and autism. September 11 truthers claim the mantle of scientific authority for themselves by claiming that they are the only people interested in posing serious questions about the science behind the collapse of the World Trade Center, an issue that comes up in O'Donnell's tweets pretty often. The Washington Post says it's a dangerous inversion of scientific thinking and the scientific process, suggesting that science can only be valid if it produces the results the movements want to see. And I think this is the very same thing that P.Z. Myers had talked about recently when he had described basically what he called pathological skepticism. I would call pathological skepticism both to an extent that, as well as, for instance, a skeptic like Brian Dunning, who fails to be able to witness and understand that there are, for instance, thousands of reports that constitute anecdotal evidence of things like UFOs. And yet they can dismiss these things without having to really pose anything more than really what amounts to speculation about these subjects. And in doing so, they claim that they have answers. That is, to me, just as much as anything, quite the, well, not only the leap in judgment, but also it can constitute being disingenuous just as well. In the next hour, when we talk with B. Timothy Pennington, you're going to hear from an individual who is, again, an American scientist. He's a chemist by trade, a member of the American Chemist Organization, and he's also a person who has long questioned UFOs. And he initially went looking for answers in the writings of the likes of Philip J. Klass, and he found it to be unsatisfactory. And so in retiring, he both had the time to do it, and he also felt that it was, sadly, academically feasible for him to do. I'm sure he'll probably still be castigated, and already has been. In fact, I've asked Tim about this. There was a review of his book that was featured at the Magonia blog. Now, I want to point out, by the way, Magonia, of course, being a blog that takes its name from Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia, or borrows it from that. But Magonia tends to kind of advocate the what's known as the psychosocial hypothesis of UFOs. And they did not write a favorable review of my book, The UFO Singularity. In truth, it was quite bad, and they said that Micah Hanks seems to have no knowledge of things like grandfather paradoxes. Actually, I would argue that if they had read enough about grandfather paradoxes, they would know that this is not, again, an accepted fundamental law of the universe. This is entirely hypothetical in trying to reason with how we can come to terms with an idea so obscure and difficult to fathom for us as, well, time travel, which we haven't, at least as far as I know, we haven't managed to successfully achieve yet. We have not proven scientifically that time travel can't occur. I'd love to see somebody try and prove or disprove a time travel hypothesis in relation to something that, speaking about time travel, doesn't actually exist yet. I'm working on building a TARDIS. I am. But last time I checked, time travel does not yet exist. Well, the point here is that, again, you know, we've got to be very careful about deconstructing the arguments of others based on our own hypothetical presumptions. They did the same thing at Magonia with B. Timothy Pennington, PhD, our guest in the next hour. And when we come back, we'll be discussing science, skeptics, and UFOs with him here on the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Broadcasting from a bunker in the hollow earth, worldwide around the globe on the internet, I'm Micah Hanks, and you've locked into the one and only Graylian Report, where we love to spend time with you educating the masses on the unusual on a weekly basis. But in doing so, we try to take a very logical and reasonable approach. You know, Jeremy, recently you were talking to me about how I think at times we all agree that it's important not to always just be really middle of the road.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll tell you this, you and I are having coffee on Sunday, and when you brought that up, I said, you know, you're absolutely right. You can't just be middle all of the time. And I will say this in relation to the discussion of UFOs. There is obviously a phenomenon. And anyone who wants to so passively deny that and just overlook it, you know, with a casual passiveness, I mean, you know, that is really the height, not only, I think, of intellectual arrogance, but it's also, it is bad science. And that's why I'm very thrilled tonight to be talking with a gentleman who's dedicated his life to science, and he's dedicated his most recent work to the study of UFOs, and he has entered a realm that most in the science community would never dare to step. Now, his name is B. Timothy Pennington, PhD, and he's the author of a book called Science, Skeptics, and UFOs. And he, not only in this book, talks about his own personal experiences with this phenomenon, but he also delves into what I think is pseudo-skeptic thinking, and really, I think, what is a very brilliant overview of the phenomenon. So without further ado, I want to welcome, for the first time to the Graylian Report, B. Timothy Pennington, PhD. How are you tonight, Tim?
Oh, just fine, Micah. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm glad to have you on here, too. And, you know, you and I have spoken on the telephone once before. I've been enjoying your book, and I call Tim today prior to the broadcast, and he tells me he's now reading The UFO Singularity. I guess when great minds think alike, they buy each other's books, and I have certainly enjoyed yours, Tim. So thank you so much for coming on the program to talk about this with us. You know, as a scientist, let me just ask you right here at the outset, as a scientist, why do you think that it's important to write about UFOs?
Well, I had to write about them because I had experienced them, and I am a scientist, and I'm trying to get at the truth of things. And I had denied them, and not really denied them, but avoided getting into it during my career. But then I realized I had to write about it because I had some unique knowledge and some unique viewpoints to bring across.
You have a very long history of involvement with this, so let's go back toward the beginning. Let's talk a little bit about your own experiences, the ones that your family's talked about. There was one that really caught my attention in your book that you described. I think it was your grandmother. And I think your father also, as a young boy, they passed through a beam of light traveling down a country road. Let's maybe start there and bring it all the way up to the present day, if we can.
Sure. That was something my grandmother used to tell us, various stories, you know, to entertain the grandkids and things. And that story I found fascinating from an early age because there's absolutely no explanation for this shaft of light. And that's, I would ask my father about it, and he would say, yes, it really happened that way. It is really unexplainable.
How did they describe that shaft of light, by the way?
Well, they described it as a shaft of light coming down for as far as you could see upwards. And in the middle of the light, it was as bright as daylight. And they would stick a hand into the light and pull it back out and just kind of cautiously examine it. And I asked him, could you see anything above the light? Could you see what was generating the light? And he would say, no, we could not. Hmm. So
it's a very odd story, you know. And now, keep in mind, by the way, also listeners at home, this appears in Tim's book, but this case actually would have taken place, about what time frame, Tim, would that have been?
It was in the 1930s.
Wow.
It would be in rural Mississippi.
Boy, I tell you, that's interesting. And again, am I correct in understanding that the light shaft was illuminating the road in front of them as they were walking home one evening, right?
Right. They saw it from a distance and couldn't figure out what it was. They thought maybe it was a fire or something of the sort. As they approached it, they said, well, it's a beam of light coming down about 30 or 40 feet wide, illuminating the road. And also they could see that they didn't have any way to get around it. It was as if it was consciously blocking the road. It was a thick briar patch on one side and barbed wire fence and thicket on the other side.
Do you think that the intent here was to actually force them to have to walk through the light?
Well, even a skeptical observer would say one might be able to draw that conclusion looking at how that the light, there's no known physical way in nature to produce the light. It had to be some sort of artificial light. It was not moving around. It was rock solid steady. I think anyone would have to conclude it appears that way.
Interesting. It is interesting. Now, this is presumably maybe the first of numerous encounters that your family would have. By the time, I'd say maybe, I guess you were in your teens, you began having your own experiences. Can you tell us about some of the things that you actually observed growing up there in Mississippi?
Well, the very first one that we observed was actually observed by my younger brother and us when we were walking one night. As we did in the summer, a lot of times we'd walk up the road and make down out in the country, enjoy the evening. And he saw a red light hovering over a field. Now, I would be in my teens at that time, and that was in 1963. And we all just totally, we glanced over there and actually saw it and was so unaccepting at that point of the phenomena that we just, oh, that's nothing. And we just ignored it. And he was so terrified that he had nightmares.
Really? Wow.
So that was the very first one, but that was one I didn't pay much attention to. Because the way I was thinking at the time, you have to realize I've come a long, long way. The way I was thinking at the time that, you know, nothing like that would ever happen out there, and the probability of ever seeing anything would be virtually zero, and, you know, it just didn't happen in our backyard. That's the way I was thinking.
Sure. I guess that's what most of us would think, you know. And then there was another instance a little later on that you experienced seeing what reminded me, I think you refer to it in your book as being the endless looping light, but it reminded me of like lights playing tag is how I might describe it. Tell us a little about that.
Well, that's a very good description, lights playing tag. That was one that we we all saw as we were walking down to our house across the street from my uncle's house. Our house was being renovated. We would go down there each night and look around and come back in the 15 or 20 minutes. We happened to be walking down one night, and it was after dark, and we saw a light. And they said, hey, well, there's an airplane going across there. But really, looking back on it, it was just a single white light, not blinking, nothing, just traveling at a steady pace. It looked like it might be an airplane up at 30,000 feet or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we were coming back, we looked up, and there it was in almost exactly the same spot. And it caught my attention. I mean, I just looked at it and was wondering what was going on. Everybody else went on inside. I stood out there and watched it, and suddenly it came to another light that was hovering. I hadn't noticed. I just, maybe background stars or something. I wasn't even thinking about it. And it got to that light and kind of touched it, like you say, playing tag, and then bounced to the side and then started back across.
Hmm.
I'm looking at it and I'm saying, what on earth can that be? And basically what I thought for a long time was just, how can that be explained? It went to another light in the other direction and did the same thing and started back. And I'm like, what is going on?
How long did you observe those two lights, Tim?
I would say my total observation time was, it took it about 30 seconds or so to make a trip back and forth, and so my observation time was about 5 minutes, maybe, something like that at most.
Interesting.
I had to get up early the next morning, go to work the summer job, and so I didn't stay out there.
You know, in your book, and this is what I love, is because you do something very similar to what Dr. Jacques Vallée has done in some of his books. You know, you look back on that encounter and you began, you did what most people and what I think are even a lot of UFO researchers don't do. I think someone had suggested to you it might have been a helicopter, and you said, okay, well, what's the upper limit of helicopter flight altitude? And let's presume a little lower than that, and then let's try and make some calculations based on the time it took to traverse a certain distance in the sky. What did you find in doing that?
Well, what I found was that it'd be very difficult for a helicopter to travel across there and look so smooth in the flight. The helicopter would have to be able to accelerate to the probably beyond the known speed limit of a helicopter, which is about 260 miles per hour. And it would have to then immediately start braking in order to stop at the light. It would have to accelerate beyond its capability and then immediately start braking. And then, instead of going smoothly into the other light that it kind of touches, and a helicopter would have to dip down and up and everything and slow its airspeed
mm-hmm.
to come in. And then it would never approach another helicopter, if that's what it was up there, that closely.
Oh,
so that was my conclusion, that it was just about impossible to be a helicopter.
I know that there are other cases that your family experienced too, and I hope you don't mind, because there's so much to cover in the course of the next hour that, you know, I'd like to jump ahead just a little bit. But I do want to tell people that, you know, if you want to check out his book, it's available on Amazon.com, and we'll have it linked at GrayleighReport.com. It's called Science, Skeptics, and UFOs, A Scientist Explores the World of UFOs. Tim, you had these encounters, your family had these things, there were multiple witness encounters where you saw these strange lights. In one case, and I will just foreshadow one more event, there was one where you thought it was literally coming almost on a collision course toward your grandparents' home, a very interesting case where a light seemed to be headed directly toward you and then averts and takes a different turn right toward the end before it would have presumably collided. You, in trying to understand these circumstances, this led you to the work of Philip J. Klass. As I understand, of course, you weren't very satisfied with his determinations about UFOs. Why?
Well, it just doesn't seem likely that the phenomena which he claimed unexplained lights like this were ball lightning. And in his initial work, he was claiming it's generated by power lines and everything, and that just does not fit these things out in the open and traveling at a constant rate of speed. And then later on, I found out that some of the things we actually saw appeared to go all the way down into the community center of Polkville and beyond at that same rate of speed. That is absolutely not ball lightning.
Mm.
And then his other explanations, there was none of the cases just didn't didn't match up at all. So, but I did feel like I needed to include a chapter in the book about Mr. Klass, as he was the premier UFO skeptic of his day.
Yeah.
Until his death just a few years ago.
Yeah, he certainly wasn't. And, you know, in your book, in fairness, you know, you point out that not every observation that he made was bad, you know? I mean, you had actually even said at one point that he might be a useful person to have on a UFO investigation team today. Why do you feel that there's merit to some of his work as well?
Because if you don't have someone like him, you will make some obvious mistakes. You will make mistakes in assuming something. And he would be right there saying, no, it can't be this. You've got to consider that. You always need someone like that. Now, some people just want yes people around them. I always wanted people that spoke what they thought, and then we'll work through the issues.
Yeah. You know, that's yeah, exactly. And that's what I like, too. I even tell these guys here in the studio with me, you know, you may not always agree with me, and if you don't, tell me, you know, because I'm open to suggestion. And that's the beautiful thing about the listenership of this program is they will let me know when they disagree. And that's where I learn things, is from disagreeing with people. But, you know, in disagreeing, do you feel that the attitude, you know, you mentioned that Klass was the preeminent skeptic of his day. What do you think about the skeptic writers of today? We talked about Brian Dunning in the last segment, and unfortunately, Tim, by the way, have you heard about this, that Brian Dunning has actually been sentenced to 15 months in prison on count of essentially, I think he's been charged with fraud is what we'd read, and he had been scamming people utilizing some sort of it was a couple of plugins, a WordPress plugin and then something that was used for MySpace. But had you heard about that?
I heard a little bit about it, yes. Yeah. I heard that he had been sentenced for fraud. I didn't know any of the details.
Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate, and I won't ask you to comment, you know, on that. But in general, in terms of skeptics of today, do you find that they take a similar attitude to what Philip Klass did, and do they make the same presumptions about UFOs that Klass might have done decades ago?
Yes and no. Klass was, at first, recognized that there was some kind of unexplained phenomena in certain UFO cases, and he explained that phenomena as ball lightning. And then you have to also consider the current earth lights, plasmas in the air, all of them combined into one. He actually considered that, and most of the ones I see really don't consider that. He also considered and stated sometime in the 2000s on an interview on Nova online that most of the UFO witnesses were credible people and not had any mental disorder and were not hallucinating. He said 98% of them were perfectly normal people. Hmm. Some of the skeptics today want to say that if you see a UFO, you've got some kind of mental illness or something of that sort.
Have you ever had anybody tell you that? Have you had somebody say that you were just plain wrong in the things that you and your family experienced?
Some of the skeptics that read my book didn't really like it that much because I really nailed them in the book, and I didn't even know that what their position was beforehand or anything like that. But what I found was their position was not logical, and that's all I can say. It just wasn't logical. And if it's not logical, there's no sense in pursuing that line of avenue. So the skeptics that I really nailed in the book, I mean, I really disagreed with. They were saying that in some of their reviews, but no one else.
I see, yeah. Well, you know, and again, you tend to find that attitude is, I think, kind of universal. I mean, as a matter of fact, I think you've talked about this a bit, and I'll mention it now, that across the board, I don't know. I mean, I think that skeptics would have us believe that most people are skeptical. But you actually, at one point in your book, you make an interesting observation that probably based on the idea that a number of people who have had experiences do not talk about what they've experienced. And based on the fact that I think, I'm trying to remember the figure, I think that, you know, some 10% of the public, you know, is supposed to be people who may have either had an experience of their own, but or this is maybe the group of the public that has strong belief tendencies, but I think that you put it a little closer to 50% or so. Do you feel that rather than this attitude that if we read only mainstream publications talking about UFOs, that would have us believe that, well, nobody who isn't out of their mind really believes this stuff. Do you think that really the true belief and maybe even people who experience things that they cannot explain is much greater or less than what we are told? I mean, what do you think about that?
My experience is that there's a lot of closet believers who don't actively come out, but actually believe at some level, at some site. I think you'd have to really have your head in the sand not to believe that there's other intelligences somewhere in the universe and that there's other beings and other technologies and things of that sort. And a lot of people believe that, and a lot of people believe that there's something going on with UFOs right here on Earth. They may not be in a position to come out and publicly with that.
Absolutely. You know, I believe that there is something going on here on planet Earth. I'm just not 100% sure yet what that is. I don't know, you know, being a scientist, if you have a feeling about that, you know, I don't know that if we don't know what these things are, that any of us can really say we're 100% sure. Is there such a thing as a UFO expert? Maybe Tim Pennington is. We'll continue our discussion with him after this when we come back on the Graylian Report. From the high mountains of Appalachia, this is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, discussing science skeptics and UFOs with B. Timothy Pennington, PhD. It's a fascinating discussion that we're having about arguably one of the greatest mysteries, to me, that faces humankind. And the fact that anybody could look at this and say there's simply nothing to see here is almost in itself, to me, an anomaly. Now, what's interesting is in his book, Timothy points out a lot of things, a lot of interesting and in what frankly are described throughout the book as illogical statements made by people. Famously, Carl Sagan, a man who spent his life searching for extraterrestrial life, probably if there was good evidence of it represented in UFO cases, should have known about it. And yet, whether or not we're talking about extraterrestrials, interdimensionals, secret government craft, whatever UFOs may be, on the whole, Sagan seemed to be extremely dismissive of those cases. Now, Tim, I'd like to ask you, in your opinion, because you do talk a good bit about Sagan and you quote him throughout the book. I mean, what are your general feelings about Sagan, his ideological perspectives about UFOs, and what may have led him to take such a skeptical stance against the subject?
Well, yeah, it's kind of hard for me. I really like Carl Sagan, but the man that he was and the scientist and everything and the statements about UFOs are absolutely make no sense whatsoever.
I agree.
And therefore, I get into it in the book. It's possible. I don't have any proof. It's possible. But I think some others, Dolan and Zabel, had a book about disclosure, mm-hmm. and they speculated about Sagan in the way that maybe he knew something and could not divulge it and could not even talk about it. So all he could do publicly was dismiss the subject. That's speculation. But to me, it fits the behavior better than anything else that I can come up with.
Well, you know, there was a case that Soraya Azkath, a good buddy of mine who also hosts a program called Where Did the Road Go? Soraya brought to my attention the fact that in his memoirs, Jacques Vallée had written about the fact that he had approached Sagan and said, look, would you give me time? I've got 10 cases. I can give you the best cases for the existence of a physical phenomenon represented by UFOs. And Sagan initially had been, you know, had been warm to this idea, but later when Vallée said, look, I've got my dossier prepared for you, Sagan blew him off and basically said, well, I haven't got time any longer. And it seems that that would indicate to me, Tim, a willful dismissal. Were you aware of that story?
I was aware of some of the details of that, yes.
Yeah.
That And Sagan, the real irony here is Sagan studied extraterrestrial. He thought about it and how they would behave and how they could travel across the galaxy and this thing as much as anyone else of his day.
Mm-hmm. Maybe
and
more.
Dismiss eyewitness reports, which study after study shows that 20 or 30% of eyewitness reports are highly accurate. And the skeptics have to dismiss all the reports. In fact, they dismiss everything they don't agree with in their prior beliefs. Well, that's a belief system. That's not science.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I see in their behavior, is dismissing things because they believe there can't be any unexplained phenomena. Now, Sagan didn't say there couldn't be any unexplained phenomena, if you look at it carefully.
Right.
So if you read between the lines, there seems to be something there.
I agree that Sagan had to have had interest in UFOs to some extent. And, you know, again, I know for a fact, of course, that you're extremely well-read in Carl Sagan, and I am too. I should say that, by the way. I, like you, Tim, am a fan of Carl Sagan and his writing. The Demon-Haunted World. I've got a friend who is an astronomy professor at Appalachian State University, and he told me last time I saw him that he actually is all, you know, as additional reading or supplemental reading, he'll ask his first-year astronomy students sometimes to read portions from that book. And I find that Sagan makes some extremely good points about UFOs, but by the same token, I think that he, again, dismisses the high strangeness cases. So I would ask you again, you know, as a man with a background in science, how do you think science can be better applied to the study of UFOs? Obviously, willful dismissal is not going to do it. Let's say that we are open-minded enough to say there is a phenomenon. How does a scientist proceed?
Well, in the classical case of a scientist, they have to have some kind of financial support in order to go out and try to collect data on their own, whatever that data might be, if they set up cameras, if they set up some sort of other radiation detectors of various sorts. They usually have to have some sort of funding, and then they have to pick a location if you're going to do a UFO study. Well, there's some places around that there's frequent sightings, and there's frequent phenomena going on. So however you do it, you have to secure funding, and funding agencies don't want to fund things that are kind of in the shadows, in the scientific shadows. So it's difficult, but it's still doable if a person has independent funds or if it's just determined to study what they can, then you go about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to bring up what I'm working on right now myself for in a second book.
Sure.
That will be coming out. And I'm using, and I don't mind saying that I'm using Google Earth, which is really a surveillance system for the planet Earth, basically, available to the public. And tedious hours of searching and finding images and trying to figure out what those images are. And that's one way you can do it, and that's what I'm pursuing right now.
Which let me say, by the way, I think that's brilliant, because how better to study our world than utilizing free and incredibly expansive technologies? You know, I mean, I think people often undermine or overlook entirely what is available right under their noses. So, and I don't mean to interrupt you, I apologize, but again, I just think it's very intelligent to go about studying something that allows you to look at the entire world, and it costs you nothing, considering, of course, the financial hurdles that, you know, so much research requires. But go ahead. As you were saying, you know, you're utilizing Google Earth. What are your objectives, and what have you been discerning utilizing Google Earth in relation to UFOs?
Well, you know, in the end of my book, I actually got into it looking at satellite images because of a sighting in June of 2013. That my brother and his family had a series of sightings, actually three of them. It got me looking as to what on earth could, you know, is there something out there? They were all occurring at one spot and three different witnesses, and my brother finally went to investigate, and he saw it. So I started looking and saw something strange. And that's at the end of the book, and I talk about it. I discuss what I end up finding. I started out on MapQuest because it was open on my computer and saw a bizarre image. Bizarre to me. Everyone doesn't see. That's what I have. I've got a burden to get people to actually see what I see. And I have to show them, actually prove what I'm seeing and why it's what I'm saying it is, from shadows and from the way the scene looks when there's nothing there. And these, and so at the end of the book, I get into that, and I find an image, and it's quite compelling to me, and that's what got me started on looking for more.
It's interesting, by the way, Tim, because I've got to say, you and I corresponded a lot prior to talking tonight, and I'm sure we will correspond more in the future. At the end of the book, you include some diagrams, and you include a rough diagram and a size comparison based on contextual clues in the images that you looked at, based on the object that you purport to see in this image. And the way you end up describing it is an awful lot like a drone. A little more narrow, little tail fins, not necessarily wings, but a lot like a drone kind of aircraft. There was this report that Caleb and I talked about last night that described an encounter recently that occurred over Canada. There were two, in fact, I think one in June and then one more recently. One of these described a red and white shaped tubular object with a rotor, whatever that means. I could envision a couple of different scenarios as to how this object might have looked. Another was just a dark wingless object at high altitude, moving at high speed, that nearly collided with an aircraft. And, of course, I wrote a book about this called The Ghost Rockets that talks about these kinds of encounters. Your description of this object and some of the aircraft and the objects that you describe in your book almost match the descriptions of these drone-like aircraft that I've taken serious interest in just as well. And I have to say that's extremely interesting to me. So I'll ask you, what is the likelihood that there are some sort of drones that are being utilized that don't maybe match the conventional, the XF-7B and the copter drones and things like that? Would you liken these to being UAVs, or is there something else going on here?
Well, that is some of the things I'm actually finding. I'm actually finding some of these things, and I'm using certain criteria to try to figure out. First of all, I have to know the size. I have to know how fast they're going, and that's possible from Google Earth Street View, if you can get a series of three or four views of the thing. And what I'm saying, it's entirely possible. There are drones out there, I can state as a fact, that are faster than anything is supposed to be. For instance, a little helicopter-type UAV, the speed limit that I've been able to find and just guess at a maximum speed is under 80 miles an hour. And some of them are only quoting 30 or 40 miles an hour or something like that. The bigger ones can go faster, like 135 miles an hour. But there are objects out there that don't fit anything that's known in that size range.
You mean in the size range that would be comparable to maybe to like a civilian drone?
Yes.
I got you. Well, what about the military drones, you know, the XF-7B and some of these aircraft? Obviously, they can move more quickly. Do you think that there's a potential that some of the aircraft could be military drones or something like that?
There's always a potential, and you need to view it from several different vantage points to be certain. There's a potential, but if you can show that it doesn't look like anything that's known, and you can show that it's actually moving faster than anything that's known, then that is a case for it being an unexplained object.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing I'm looking for.
Absolutely. Something that defies what we know should exist out there. But, you know, as interesting as the drone discussion is, there appear to be extremely large aircraft. I mean, some cases, notable cases, of course, the Phoenix Lights. There was a UFO flap over Stephenville, in Texas, I think, was that 2008? I think it's been a few years now.
Yeah, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you discussed those in your book just as well. What do we make of these larger cases? You know, in some instances that police officers have chased that seem to involve football, you know, sized triangular objects and things like this. What kind of technology is this supposed to be, you know?
Well, these things, it appears to be absolutely a valid sightings by the witnesses. Something huge went overhead. Nothing that huge is supposed to exist in our known technology. So immediately you can say that it's beyond what is supposed to be known, okay? And then the behavior, and then there's radar data showing associated objects with these huge objects and their behavior, and they behave in a way that is very unlikely for a government test or something that would fly over sensitive areas. You would avoid sensitive areas. You'd be out in a test range somewhere. Then you have to suspect that there is something else going on here.
That is a good point, by the way. The fact that, you know, again, there was this case that took place back in, I think it was maybe January of 2000, where police departments throughout Illinois chased what was described as a large triangle-shaped object that was flying at low altitude over a suburban area. I mean, people were seeing this thing. Police officers were seeing it. Now, it was in the middle of the night, so it was less likely that people would see it. But if it were a government test, why in the world would they fly over an area where they are more likely to be seen rather than maybe out over the Midwestern United States? Or, you know, presumably is the one of the reasons that we don't see more UFOs because maybe they are flying out, you know, or at times of day that would cause them to be less likely to be seen, or maybe in regions of the country that there are less there are less instance of population that would be conducive to mass witness sightings. I don't know if that would necessarily be something we could even quantify because, you know, obviously if these things are flying where there are fewer people, there aren't going to be people to report these UFOs. So, but it doesn't make sense that when we do have these cases of these objects seen over urban areas, you know, that they're flying at low altitude and allowing police to stand there and, you know, photograph them and chase them like happened in 2000 over Illinois. It doesn't seem to fit the criteria for being some sort of a military operation with certain craft, does it?
Well, it's against all regulations.
That's a good point, too. Yeah.
I know people sneer at me and say, oh, well, the government doesn't always follow the regulations. But if you're military and you're not following regulations, you get in huge trouble if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And so it argues that you wouldn't be testing anything out over civilian cities and areas like that.
So if not a test, then let's just try and apply a bit of logic to the circumstances you do throughout your book, of course. If not a test, what might be the purpose of a low-altitude flyby featuring a large aircraft like this, as has been reported in the Stephenville cases, the Phoenix Lights, you know, the incident up there in Illinois in 2000? What might be the purpose if we were to infer anything from these?
The purpose, if it's human-generated, It doesn't seem to have that much of a purpose. you know that if I have this technology and I say, aha, I'm going to spring it on people and see what they do. The purpose could be to see what the reaction would be.
Hmm. Yeah.
That's the only purpose I can figure out. You spring it on people and see what kind of reaction they have about it.
Right. If we're talking about something that's terrestrial. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Now, alternatively, if it were something else, maybe it's difficult to assume what the reason for an extraterrestrial or an interdimensional, you know, phenomena or technology, you know, why they would behave a certain way. Maybe that's one of the problems that we have with expectations about alien life, is that, you know, we have this anthropomorphic attitude, you know, that we can't escape because we're humans, and we're always applying that to things. In that line of thought, Tim, you know, I want to ask you this, too. Toward the end of the book, you go through a range of things, by the way, throughout the book. You deal with, you know, the earthquake lights and plasmas and things, just like Philip Klass had talked about. But toward the end of the book, you know, you give a nice summary of the different logical possibilities. In your study, and I will ask you to speculate here a bit, is there any potential that you feel is more likely than another in relation to a majority of what appear to be intelligently controlled UFO sightings? Is there a greater potential that seems to stand out among others for those? And I know some of these cases obviously involve, you know, ambiguous lights and things like that, but of the craft that appear to be intelligently controlled, actual physical nuts and bolts aircraft, is there anything that stands out to you among the potentials as far as a source of what? What are these things?
That's what I'm wrestling with, trying to understand that. In the last chapter of my book, I wrestle mightily with it.
Yeah.
And in the second book, I'm going to be wrestling mightily with it even more as to what this is. Now, right off the bat, it doesn't seem to match what we would do if we went to another planet. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to match that. And if it doesn't match that, then we have to think beyond that. We have to think, what could this possibly be? And I speculate, too, in the book, and give it as a possibility, which I don't see in many places. But that maybe it's a technology. Maybe it's beings that were here on this earth before we were, that have figured it all out. They figured out how to extract energy just from the sun or from wherever, from zero point energy in the vacuum. You know, it's particles are spontaneously generated and things of that sort.
Yeah.
Maybe they figured it all out, and maybe they just have a little fun every now and then.
the best that we know, Tim. I said the best that we know, that could be as good an explanation as anything.
Just have a little fun with us sometimes. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm mightily trying to find out.
Yeah. I have to say, you know, again, in your book, I think, and I mean this entirely as a compliment, I think that people, when they read your book, they will be surprised. And you go over a lot of very, very, very well-presented cases, some of them your own, some of them that have taken place in relation to others. And speaking of those that take place in relation to others, there is one case I certainly want to ask you about, because we've talked about UFOs and nuts and bolts craft. But before we run out of time here, we've got a few minutes left. During the time in the 1970s that you and your family in Mississippi were experiencing a lot of things yourself, there was a very famous, perhaps one of the most famous, purported alien abduction cases of all time. That was the Pascagoula, Mississippi incident. What are your general thoughts about that? And do you have anything that you'd like to offer in relation to what was going on in the case with Hixon and Parker and their purported abduction?
Well, Hixon and Parker, the hidden microphone caught them. That is a transcript, and they say the tape itself. Two men that did not know what had happened to them and were trying to understand it. I mean, they were absolutely authentic, absolutely believed everything they were saying. And that case, to me, the actual blue light and the object and everything didn't quite match up with everything we saw. But then later, Hixon and his family had a sighting, the Mother's Day sighting in 1974, that fit to a T a lot of the sightings that my family experienced.
Interesting.
And so my thoughts are that there's a relationship there. And in the book, I plot these things up and find a corridor, what looks like a UFO corridor in the state of Mississippi. And that this is where a lot of the most famous sightings have occurred, some of the most unexplainable sightings have occurred. And just, my book was published in January of 2014, and the Combest Bluff lights incident, where these lights came down and recorded on a deer camera, infrared camera, occurred in February, right in the center of where I draw my UFO corridor, and near the Gulf Coast. And the phenomenon is exactly similar to what my family experienced. So there is something that's been going on in that section of Mississippi and been going on for quite a while.
Interesting. Do you think, you describe what you called a corridor in the Mississippi area, do you think that there is the potential that corridors akin to that could exist in other parts of the world?
I absolutely believe so. I don't think that's an isolated case. And it could be that just by chance, all these cases came to light in this way, in which is almost a straight line from Flora, Mississippi to Pascagoula, Mississippi, and our sightings lie not far off a straight line between those two. That could happen by chance, but I don't think so.
You know, and then there are people, I think, Tim, though, that would say that, oh, well, you know, perhaps the perception among the public that there is a phenomenon greater than ball lightning, greater than misinterpretation of celestial phenomenon and airplanes flying at high altitude. Maybe it is at very least possible that people are just seeing things, and that this entire subculture surrounding the UFO phenomenon is based on erroneous interpretation of otherwise prosaic events. I happen not to believe that, and I think that you make a good case for why that's not the case in your book. The book is Science, Skeptics, and UFOs, A Reluctant Scientist Explores the World of UFOs. Timothy Pennington, PhD, I like to thank you so much for being on the show with us. Tim, I hope you also come back from time to time because, you know, I'd love to be able to pick your brain more, not just about this subject, but about chemistry as well. I know you, of course, have been a professional chemist for, you know, your career, and I'm so glad now that you're contributing to the UFO field just as well.
Well, thank you very much, Micah, and I appreciate the invitation, and thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, we'll definitely do it again. And the book, folks, can be found on Amazon.com. It is, again, Science, Skeptics, and UFOs. Tim, is there a way that people can find you online or contact you otherwise via the World Wide Web?
Well, I have a website, but I'm not very good at managing a website. It's just... And I have a Facebook page with the title of the book, Science, Skeptics, and UFOs.
Very good. Excellent. Skeptics and or Science, Skeptics, and UFOs on Facebook. That's probably a good way to find it. You know, I'm as adept as I am at social media and computers, Tim. My problem is finding the time to be able to use them to my best benefit. So, anywho, I wish you all the best with the book, my friend, and I'll be in touch with you after the interview as well. So thank you again for joining us here on The Grailian, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Micah.
Absolutely, and a good evening to you. Well, folks, I tell you, it's really interesting, and I'm always glad to hear from people in the science community who are willing to put their name and their reputation, if not on hold, at stake to discuss these kinds of subjects. It's something that we discuss every week on this program, and we're going to wrap things up in the final segment where I think after talking with a scientist who has held his science for his silence. He's held his science too, but he's held his silence for decades on this subject and has finally come clean himself and said, look, there's something going on. What are we dealing with? The boys in the bunker and I, when we wrap things up after this, we'll look at the possibilities when we come back. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grailian Report, wrapping up another edition of the weirdest podcast anywhere on the web, where we try and put a little bit of light on the subject of things like UFOs, Bigfoot, cryptids, fringe science, news, politics, conspiracies, all of it. I like to think of it as maybe one of the most well-rounded podcasts that deals with these subjects. And in being well-rounded, I want to thank again author B. Timothy Pennington, PhD, for joining us to discuss Science, Skeptics, and UFOs. Again, I was really surprised. I read this book, and I didn't just get a review copy, by the way. I bought this book because the title compelled me so much, and reading that book, I was very impressed. You know, and that's the thing. I may not agree with everything that Tim says in the book. He may not agree with everything that I've said in my book, but I appreciate a person who tries to be logical, and that's primarily his thing. He's trying to be logical about his approach in studying this. I highly recommend the book. And of course, you know, we'll no doubt hear more from him in the future, as I know he's working on another book. Now, I'm going to risk endangerment here and take this over. Are you breathing into the microphone over there?
Oh yeah.
I'm going to risk endangerment because I want to have a little bit of fun. You know, it's been a pretty rough couple of days with obviously with Robin Williams. That's had everybody kind of feeling weird.
Yeah,
that's just been extremely strange. And you can get so heady and introspective with the situation with UFOs that, I mean, it can get to a point where you also are not having any fun with it. So having a little fun of it, Caleb, I want to go with you first. What do you think? What are UFOs? What is this? What does this phenomena represent to you?
I was just discussing with the chat room that I thought that maybe they were piloted by a fleet of potato dwarves.
Well, that's a perspective, I think.
That makes more sense to me than anything else.
I see. I thought Caleb was going to talk about artificial intelligence.
Well, AI maybe, but potato dwarf. That's where I'm going to go.
Potato dwarf. Yeah, well, as long as it's not a human walrus hybrid. Jeremy, I don't know. What are your feelings? I mean, if you had to say, okay, UFOs to me, based on what I know, what is the estimate of the situation, as the Air Force once put it? What are we most likely dealing with to you?
I think we're most likely dealing with human beings.
Yeah?
Yeah, I really don't think that we have extraterrestrial life visiting the world.
I'm
not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it's not probable. I just really don't feel like we're being visited by extraterrestrials. Now, it's not to say that the ancient alien theory isn't right and that we were visited long ago, but I really don't think it's happening now. I think what we're seeing is advanced technology that we can't explain because the government isn't explaining to us. And, you know, I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theorist here, but,
sure.
You know, that's more probable to me than to say that we've got gray aliens flying around in saucers, you know, wanting to probe us. That's just kind of my stance on it.
Jeremy, given that there has been talk before that the government was trying to engineer chimeras or super soldiers utilizing ape-human hybrids, what do you think the potential for a potato dwarf is?
I think it's highly probable.
And do you think that the government is utilizing potato dwarfs to our disadvantage?
Yes.
You know, actually, in all seriousness, though, I just can't be funny. I've got to be serious. No, I can be funny. I can be very funny, but... But right now, funny looking, I guess, you know, it's, again, Facebook.
Looks aren't everything.
Yeah, Facebook radio, you know. But now I will say this, actually, in relation to what Caleb was saying, though, about chimeras and about, you know, human ape hybrids. I think that there was almost kind of a similar argument that was made, that a few people have made. What was the writer's name? Was it Annie Jacobson? Was she the one that did the book on the idea that basically that there were genetically altered children or something like this? Some people have, over the years, others have said that it was, you know, surgically altered, rather, I think, monkeys and things like this. And all these different cases for what could have... I think even Bill Cooper had talked about
walrus
this.
Walrus people?
Yeah, right. Oh, God, that's the last thing I wanted to hear.
Tusk.
Yes. I mean, but the idea that there are, you know, ways that someone or some organization might utilize the apparent presence of aliens in the absence of actual aliens, you know, in other words, for example, I think that Bill Cooper claimed that he had come across files at, I think it was while he was stationed at Pearl Harbor, and he claimed that there was a file that he'd read that talked about the surgical alteration and shaving of monkeys to make them look like humanoid beings that were not monkey-like, that would look more human-like, but not human, obviously, smaller, you know, with more animalistic characteristics in order to mislead people into thinking. And again, here's the idea. You drop a aircraft, or what was believed to be an aircraft, full of these things onto the ground, and, you know, hence you've got Roswell. There's no proof for that, but this is, again, one perspective on the Roswell conspiracy, that the entire thing was a psyop that included something that was made to look like humans.
I think one of them is still here on Earth, and that's Gilbert Gottfried.
Well, that's, if anybody's an alien,
I mean,
that guy is.
I kind of see that. I mean, have you ever seen a shaved bear? I know this sounds weird.
Yeah, they're, I mean, that's kind of what some people think is chupacabra.
I know, it's the most terrifying thing I've ever seen. It really looks like a werewolf, or like my idea of what a werewolf looks like. So I can kind of get that train of thought.
And not to interrupt, but another good case, you know, Jeremy, would be like, for instance, you know, you look at animals that get mange, and all of a sudden a raccoon or a fox doesn't look much like a raccoon or a fox, and you've got this whole mythos surrounding the chupacabra that stems from that. Now, I think that there's something deeper to the chupacabra, and it doesn't have to do with mangy dogs.
A coyote with alopecia.
Yeah. Well, yeah, see, it's just that I don't think that, to me, the early reports of chupacabra had anything to do with anything dog-like. And what's really interesting to me is that this phenomena has morphed, you know, like Beyonce during a Super Bowl performance, you know, at the behest of her Illuminati overlords. You see, it's so hilarious to me that it has changed.
Oh, my God. Did you just make an Illuminati chupacabra connection?
You know, I really think I might. I think I may have actually done that. I don't know. It's interesting. It's food for thought. But I'll leave folks at home with this. As I've said before on the program, I couldn't tell you what the UFO phenomenon is, but I will tell you this. I haven't seen proof that aliens are visiting. What I do know is that there's a phenomenon. the first place I'll look to try and understand that phenomenon is right here at home. But that doesn't that does not remove the possibility that there is something more than what we can explain alone, whether it be through human technologies known to exist or through an anthropomorphic outlook at things that we would presume belong to someone else. And I don't know what it is, but there's damn sure a mystery here. And I commend people like B. Timothy Pennington for discussing this on this program with us, as well as the likes of Richard Dolan and, of course, as always, the boys in the bunker, Jeremy London and Caleb Hanks. Guys, another fine program under the belt, and thank you so much for your participation.
Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
When the shadow government shows up this week, I'm going to point at you guys and say they're the ones you want. And thank you guys, all of you out there in Gradio Land, for listening for another week in the Weird. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Jeremy London, Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends, and as always, stay strange out there.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.